Psalm 112, 1 and 2. Hallelujah! Oh, the bliss of the man who reveres the Lord, who greatly delights in His ordinances. His offspring shall be mighty in the land. A blessing will attend the race of the upright. Now, I believe that verse. That verse has been a guiding light for me for 23 years. I was chatting with a couple just briefly, and there's nothing more important in your parenting than your personal walk with God, than being a personal follower and obeyer and lover of God. That is paramount if you expect success. You cannot be passive in your relationship with God. You cannot be lethargic in your relationship with God. You must be a seeker of God. And secondly, a seeker of God's wisdom. I want to read just a couple verses to you. And I want you to think of these in terms of the absolutes that they really are. This is Proverbs 1. I'm going to read from the Living Bible so you can just listen, because it'll be a lot different than yours. Wisdom shouts in the streets for a hearing. She calls out to the crowds, to the judges in their courts, to everyone in the land, you simpletons. How long will you go on being fools? How long will you scoff at wisdom and fight the facts? Come here and listen to me. I will pour out the spirit of wisdom on you and make you wise. I have called you so often, but you still won't come. I have pleaded, but all in vain, for you have spurned my counsel and my reproof. And in my view, that's American Christianity. We have spurned the counsel of God and His rebuke. Someday you'll be in trouble when a storm of terror surrounds you, when you are engulfed with anguish and distress. Then I will not answer your cry for help. It will be too late, though you search for me ever so anxiously. Remember, that's wisdom. There comes a time when you want the wisdom really bad, but it's too late, and it will not be easily found by you anymore. For you closed your eyes to the facts and did not choose to reverence and trust the Lord. And you turned your back on me, spurning my advice. That is why you must eat the bitter fruit of having your own way and experience the full terror of the pathway you've chosen. For you've turned away from me to death. Your own complacency will kill you. Fools, but all who listen to me will live in peace and safety, unafraid. Chapter 2, every young man who listens to me and obeys my instruction will be given wisdom and good sense. Yes, if you want better insight and discernment, and you are searching for them as you would for lost money or hidden treasure, then wisdom will be given you and knowledge of God Himself, and you will soon learn the importance of reverence for the Lord and of trusting Him, for the Lord grants wisdom. His every word is a treasure of knowledge and understanding. He grants good sense to the godly. His saints, He is their shield, protecting them and guarding their pathway. He shows them how to distinguish right from wrong, how to find the right decision every time. For wisdom and truth will enter the very center of your being, filling your life with joy. I could go on and on and on and on. Proverbs says, though it costs you everything, get wisdom. Now, I want to make a statement. I mean this, although it's going to, you know, shock some of you, and I'll try to explain it the best I can, but in all the years as a parent, I've been a parent now for almost 20 years, I have never not known what to do next. Never. There's never been a time that I have not known what to do next. But here's why. I don't mean by that statement that I know everything. I mean that I realized I didn't know it and where I needed to go to get the information. And I have never allowed my seeking of God to become lethargic and complacent, because I know that God is the ultimate Father, and I know that He knows what my children need, and I know that I need His mentorship and His wisdom and His insight. When I was young, like many of you in this room, I sat listening to other pastors who were telling me not the identical things, but things similar, and I logged them in my brain and I logged them in my heart, and I put them into application as quickly as I possibly could. And whenever I came up against something and I thought, oh my goodness, I sought the Lord. I sought the Lord. And then I stepped out with the courage to do what others were unwilling to do. I remember, I'll tell you this story before I get into this other content. It's going to take courage for you to obey the Lord. Okay? It's not going to be easy. And family and friends, they aren't going to understand what you do. My family and friends have never understood what I've done. I want to tell you two quick stories. The first one is how quickly you can become a fool. And why the verse that we read there in Proverbs is really true. There may come a day after you've turned your back on wisdom that you realize, wow, my life's really screwed up. And you try to go a different path, but you can't because you're so immersed in it that you just can't see the light anymore. So tell you the story of my father really quickly. And I believe everything in our lives happens for a divine reason. I genuinely that even though I chafe against it sometimes, I kick and scream, and I don't always like what God does. I do genuinely believe that everything's happened in my life for a divine and sovereign reason. And I believe God gave me my father for a divine and eternal purpose. My father and mother, when they were married, my father was not a Christian. My mother was. She knew better than to marry my dad. She did it anyway. She married my dad because she could not believe, and I've talked to her about this, she's told me this, that someone so good-looking, confident, charismatic would love her. My father was an extremely good-looking man at 19, 20 years old. Unbelievably so. He was a fighter, had 132 fights, and won 117 all by knockout. My father was an unbelievable athlete in his time. And he used to come to the drugstore where my mother worked, and he kind of swept her off her feet. She admits that. She was not a very confident person. He was extremely confident. My father's far more charismatic and articulate than I am. And he just kind of swept her off her feet. Well, he was, you know, good Catholic. Not really. He wasn't that good of a Catholic at that, but that was his background. So my mother, she got engaged, she married him, but of course, you know, he didn't know the Lord at all. He knew about God, but he didn't have a walk with him. She began praying for him, and we moved to California right after I was born, to Los Angeles, outside of Los Angeles. My father was a welder at night. He went to night school, worked during the day welding, went to night school for welding engineer in the evening. And there was a guy there who was kind of a nutcase, and he won my dad to Christ. And so my father, I think, came to the Lord when he's about... I mean, this guy was really a fanatic for his faith. And so my dad, I think I was... How old was my dad? I think he was 21 when I was born. And so by the time I was one, my dad was saved. And my dad, he's an all-or-nothing kind of guy. And I kind of got some of that same gene pool. And so he just went radical. He'd read his Bible every night. Every night he'd come home. I remember this when I was 3 and 4 and 5. He'd come home and go to his den. After he'd kiss us all, he'd go to the den and he'd listen to 30 minutes of M.R. DeHaan, Back to the Bible broadcast. Then he'd listen to Theodore Epp for another 30 minutes. Then he'd have his prayer time and he'd be in his Bible. My dad would take us sometimes on the weekend. Quite often we'd go to the L.A. Skid Row missions. My dad would preach. My mom would play the piano and I'd stand in front and direct the music. Little three-year-old up in front now. All the winos and derelicts thought that was really cool. And my dad would give you the shirt off his back. I developed a compassionate nature to whatever degree I have it from watching my mother and my father. My mother, she regularly took pies to an elderly neighbor gentleman whose wife had died. He was about 30 years older than my mom. And she'd go over almost every other day, take him pie and say, Lee, how are you doing? When he ended up in the nursing home, he would go and see her, and she got to be there. I remember when she called me, she said, you know, Mark, it's always my prayer to be with Lee when he died. And today I sat with him and held his hand, and he died. And that was my mom. You know, she's a very, very tender woman, very kind. And my father was very strong, very heroic, but very compassionate and very outspoken and very opinionated and almost always right. And I really looked up to him. When I was about 7, we moved from California back to Iowa. And my father opened up a welding supply store. And little by little, my father, I could see, but I was only little then, was beginning to drift from core values. My father really wanted to be a pastor. He was told he couldn't because he'd been married before. My father was married when he was 17, which I don't believe the Bible literally teaches because he was not a Christian at that time. But he was told he was uneducated. My father only went through the 7th grade. My mother went through the 4th grade. And so, you know, my father, one thing he does do, he never dealt with, the fact is he bears grudges. So my father began to sow this seed of a little bit of bitterness. And then he had some major trials come, financial, that I can completely relate to now as a dad with four children. He and mom, he was working three jobs. He'd saved up enough money to buy a little house in Burbank. We bought the little house, filled it with a little furniture, nothing fancy, because I remember it. And 2 months after they did that, he showed up at work, and there was chains on all the doors, and the government had shut him down because they filed Chapter 11. Now, you know, as I'm a husband and a father, I understand what that kind of thing could feel like. But my dad, he just internalized it. And little by little, my dad would develop the philosophy that the only person who'll look out for you is you. So we moved back to Iowa. My dad began to drift. He'd come to church. It used to be church with two or three times a week, and he was serving the Lord and sharing his faith all the time. And he'd preach when the pastor was gone, or he'd teach the adult Sunday school, or he'd travel to other churches and preach. My dad, he took a job selling where he was gone four nights a week. But he was trying to improve the family lot, and he was very committed to that. My mom. And so we lived out in this little country house out in Sunbury, Iowa. It was about 20 people lived in the town. It was a weird little town. And he'd show me where the guns were. He always had a rifle and a pistol in the house. I don't know what you think about that, and I'm not here to talk about whether you have a gun or not in your house. I'm just telling you my background. And he'd tell me, "Now, Mark, it's your responsibility. You know, if anything ever happens and I'm gone, you know, here's where these are." Because there was a couple weird people in town. I said, okay. So, and I'll never forget one night when someone was in our backyard walking around ramming their car into the back of our garage. And my mother got me up to 2 a.m. I was 9 years old. My dad was out on the road. She was shaken. She was so scared. So I remember I went into my dad's room and I got the pistol and I got the rifle and I got my own bow and arrow. And I just... And I'm sitting down in the living room with my mom, you know, and the gun's right here. I'll protect you, Mom. You know, and my dad was out on the road, you know, trying to provide for the family. Little by little, my father just began to drift and drift and drift. And pretty soon he started not taking in his Bible. And I noticed, I was very perceptive. I've always been very perceptive. And I just noticed his Bible was standing. Then one day I noticed he brought home this book about this thick. I opened it, it had over 1,000 pages. I thought, wow. My dad is so smart, 1,000-page book. I'd never seen one. And it was entitled The World's Philosophers. Nietzsche, Russell, Voltaire, I mean, all the garbage morons you could possibly think of, they were in this book. But I didn't know they were garbage morons then. My dad, pretty soon he was quoting them and not the Bible anymore. By the time I was 13, my dad was not going to church at all, and we'd moved to Webster City, Iowa. I was 13 or 14 at that time, and my dad... totally disengaged, and pretty soon my dad would sit at the table and spouse hate against Jews, hate against African Americans. Everybody was the problem but my dad, everybody. And my dad would espouse communism. My father completely embraced communism and socialism, and all because he wanted to be rich personally, and he was mad at everybody else because they were rich. My mother would regularly get up from the table in tears. I have a very tender-hearted mom, and I got sort of that nature. Sometimes I wished I didn't, because it's kind of embarrassing, but now I'm not so embarrassed about it anymore. I think I've grown to be man enough to handle it. But she'd get up and she'd just watch. But my father's very influential. See, he was the influencer in the family. And he could talk and he could make you buy into anything. And, you know, I thought it was pretty cool. So pretty soon I was using the words my dad was using. And I told my mom, "Father's 15, I ain't going to your stupid church anymore. Christianity's just for a bunch of women anyway. I don't want to go." Broke her heart. I didn't go. By the time I was 18, 19, I left home, and my father, he'd leave home for a month at a time. Then he'd show back up. He'd leave for a month at a time. My mother never knew if he was going to walk back through the door or not. Finally, my dad told her, he said, "You know, Martha, I don't want to work anymore. I've been working all these years. You do something." My mom, you know, she worked very hard taking care of him, devoted her whole life to him and us six kids. So she went out and got a job at a bank, and finally, my dad, one day, he just... came in the house, and I had just gotten married, and he packed up all his belongings. The kids were all in the living room, looking out the picture window down at the driveway. Packed up all his belongings, put them in the truck, got in the truck, drove off, never came back. Abandoned his family, never sent a dime home, never has. Been married, I think, four times since, without divorcing my mother. I don't know him. I don't know where he's at. And he doesn't know any of my children. He wouldn't know my 19-year-old daughter if he saw her on the street. He wouldn't know my 18-year-old son. He's seen Micah once. Micah's 10. I'm not mad at my dad. I'm really not. I don't have resentment. But I'll tell you this. He's a major object lesson to my life. Complacency will destroy your life. You mess around with a little bitterness. You sow a little grudge. You sow a little hate. You don't guard your heart, and the devil will rape your soul. And he's laughing all the way. He enjoys it. And I'll tell you what. My father now, he's seen me. My father used to tell me when he saw me, just before I got married, he'd say real cutting remarks. He'd say, "Oh, Mark, you know, manna don't grow on trees. Wait till you get married someday." And I'd say, "You know, Dad, I welcome the day. Because I will never do what you did." God is the same God yesterday and today and forever. And pretty soon I started answering back with Scripture. Because I started to get to know it. I'd never read it much. Then I had a family. And then I had kids. And I had kids without insurance. And I only had a $200 car. And I lived below the poverty level for 7 years straight. In the first years of our marriage, way below the poverty level. And God always took care of us. And there was always food on the table. And we always had a shirt on our back. And we were happy. And then I remember my mother. Now my mother, she's very devout and she really loves the Lord. But there was one area that my mother and father argued about all the time when I was a kid. And it was about disciplining the children. My mom had a very tender heart and she did not want to see her children crying. My father, in those early days, was a very loving, he's a very affectionate man. And he didn't mind spanking your bottom. And my bottom needed it. And I'll never forget, with my second child, I was staying in the garage that my mom and dad, before he left, they converted into like a little extra spare bedroom. And I was staying there and I was working with my son. And I, you know, she's just like, this is no problem. Mom realizes, you know, that I'm going to discipline my children. My mom came to the door, knocked on the door. I opened the door and she's bawling. Her face is bright red. Her eyes are bloodshot. Tears are rolling down her eyes. And she says, "Mark, I'm sorry. You just can't do that to my grandchild." And I looked her in the eye and this probably wasn't the most loving thing. And I later apologized for it. And we have a very good relationship. I love my mother. She's very precious to me. I owe my life to my mom, to her faith and her love and her prayers. I said, "Mom," I said, "this is the very thing that you and Dad used to argue about all the time, you remember? And Dad would get frustrated and walk away, Mom." I said, "Mom, do you realize the temper that I've had to deal with in my life because you wouldn't let Dad spank my butt? Do you realize how much easier my life would have been, Mom, if at 3, you would have taught me self-control instead of when I'm 20 and I'm throwing chairs against the wall?" She got the point, but she didn't like it. So I determined, well, I'll never do this again in your presence. And I never stay longer than 2 days. And I never have. Because when the children are small, 2 days without some discipline undoes everything you've tried to do the week before. And I ain't going to do it. And I don't care if my mom doesn't like me, and I don't care if nobody understands. Let me tell you something. I don't live life to be liked. I only live for the audience of one individual, and that individual is God, my Heavenly Father, who loves me, and all I care about is making Him happy. All I care about is His well done, good and faithful servant. And I could care less if Mom thinks I'm great or not. She realizes now that Mark made all the right choices. But I took a lot of flack, even from the godly relatives in my extended family. I don't mind. I don't mind because I know what my life's about. Now, let's get to your sheet here in a minute. I knew this was going to happen to me, but I just have so many things I want to tell you. And I actually know there's so many things that you wish to know. I believe that you and I can make a tremendous difference with our children, but we have to be very proactive. What I meant earlier when I used the analogy of a newborn baby, when you have a newborn baby, you must be a very involved parent, right? That's what I was meaning. You must be very engaged. What I'm trying to get across to you is that you must be very engaged to that same level throughout the lives of your children. But the engagement process is a little different. Instead of being engaged changing the diaper, you're engaged in a relationship. You're engaged emotionally. I am regularly dumbfounded by the emotional stupidity of adults. There's a man who's written a book now, and it's like everybody's talking about emotional intelligence. Give me a break. Every Christian ought to have emotional intelligence. We're emotional beings. If we don't understand our child, if we don't... How hard is it? You're sitting at the table, you've got a 13-year-old child, and you look at their face, and by the way, this is biblical. It says in Genesis, the Lord said this to, I think it was Cain, "Cain, why are you so downcast? Why, give this up, and your life can be something positive." That's basically the thought there. You mean to tell me, dads, you can't look at your own child and know they look a little weighed down? That didn't take a brain surgeon to be able to look at your child and go, they're not their normal, peppy self. Or they're not smiling. Or they're not talking very much. I mean, did it take a brain surgeon to figure that out and to say, sweetheart, is something bothering you? No. No. Hey, listen, I'm your dad. I love you. I've known you since you came home from the hospital. What's bothering you? Something on your mind? You not feeling well? No, I'm feeling okay. Did you have a hard day at school? You start asking questions. You start probing. And you don't let them go till you find out. Now, my son, he's really changed a lot over the years, Jeremy. But Jeremy has a hard time when he's feeling emotional expressing himself. Celeste, on the other hand, not a problem. Jesse, not really a problem. Me, not really a problem. But he's a little bit like Kathy. Kathy has, when she gets really emotional, it's a little hard for to get the words out. I've sat on the edge of my son's bed when he was 15 for an hour while he tried to get it out what was bothering him. I'm serious about this stuff, folks. It's not a game. I didn't say, look, Jeremy, I got 5 minutes. Spit it out or just sit here and sulk. I don't care. You know, some people are going to do that. So Jeremy, he'd start, it would like he'd get a stutter. He'd start to talk, he'd go, well, I said, look, Jeremy, if it relates to me, if I'm the problem, don't worry about hurting my feelings. If you need to say something to me like, you know, Dad, sometimes you just drive the crap out of me, you just bug me, you can say that to me. I can take that. Maybe that is what's going on. Maybe I did do something that was offensive to you. I love you. There's times I've shed tears as I'm sitting there holding his hand or stroking his back or just sitting there doing nothing. Go, well, son, I'm staying here till we talk. So you want to just get together? I'll just be here on the chair. Now it's just not a problem. It's just not a problem at all. And, you know, he can come through that door. And I look at him, is he smiling? Is he peppy? He's usually peppy. He's usually smiling. Seems a little preoccupied. So now the question is, son, thinking about girls? Is that what's going on? Now, I'm no dummy. I'm not an idiot. I was 18 once. How'd you know, Dad? I don't know. Sometimes it can be kind of a pain, can it? You know, girls, you can't live without them. Sometimes you can't live with them. It's kind of a difficult challenge, isn't it? Yeah, he goes, Dad. So we talk. The same way with my daughters. That's spiritualness to me. That's not a gift. That's not emotional intelligence. That's just, if we're walking in the Spirit, we're caring about the needs of others. They may be physical needs, emotional needs, spiritual needs, intellectual needs, whatever they are. Now, let's get to your sheet. Getting your family to Mars. This is why I entitled this, all right? I wanted to have a whiteboard up here, but I don't, so I'm going to paint this with words. Parenting is like flying to Mars. If you don't plot your course carefully over the next 20 years, you'll miss the planet completely. Now, I want to explain something to you about this. This is very important that you understand this. Mars is millions and millions and millions of miles away, right? I think the sun is 93 million miles away. Is that right? Is it 93 million? And Mars is a long ways away, all right? Now, if I'm over at this side of the room over here, and my goal in life is to be able to, my goal is that wall, I can start at any point along this wall, walk diagonal, crooked, and still hit the wall. You follow me? It's not a big deal. Parenting is a 20-year process. There are planets that would take you 20 years to get to. If you are off an inch in your original calculations, by the time you get 20 years out, guess what? Do you hit the planet somewhere? Lonnie, Mr. Engineer, do you hit the planet somewhere? You're way off. In fact, the planet's no longer in your sight. And you're out there in the blackness of space wondering, where the heck am I and how did I get here? Okay? Parenting is as challenging and takes as many calculations and planning and preparation as getting to Mars. Okay, do y'all understand that analogy? Y'all get that? The closer the object is, the less accurate I can be. The farther away, the more accurate I must be. If I'm one foot off now, I'll be off millions of miles out in space. The same is true with parenting. The destination is 20 years away. I want to read a verse to you. Again, it's from the Living Proverbs. It won't read like this in your Bible, so just listen to this one. Proverbs 24, 3 and 4. Any enterprise. So I'm going to put the family, because the family's an enterprise. The family is built by wise planning, becomes strong through common sense, and profits wonderfully by keeping abreast of the facts. This is a great parenting verse. First of all, you must have a very effective and well thought out plan to your parenting. How many of you men have ever remodeled a kitchen or anything else in your house? But you've ever done a kitchen, okay? All right. Now, I want you to imagine this for a moment. You get your little house, and it's a fixer-upper. You move in. You walk into the kitchen. You go, you know, I still like the kitchen. I'm going to do something with it. Great. You start pulling up the linoleum, ripping out the cupboards. You don't really know what you're going to do with the kitchen. You just know you don't like the kitchen. How many of you have ever done a remodeling project like that? I knew there'd be a few of you. I was talking to Doug Patterson when he was doing his remodeling kitchen, and we were talking about this analogy. He goes, oh man, Mark, I had it all on computer. I had it laid out. I had the schematic. I knew where the wall was going to go. Listen, the bottom line is most of you have planned your remodeling a lot more than you've ever planned your parenting and your family. That's got to change. That's got to change. You investigated if you wanted a Corian counter, if you wanted Formica, if you wanted stainless steel. You investigated whether you wanted an enamel-coated sink or a stainless steel sink. Do I want white cupboards? Before you ever took the old cupboards down, you knew what cupboards were going to go in their place. Before you decided, let's rip up the floor, you figured out, do we even have the money to remodel this thing? Didn't you? I know you did. I know most of you did. Why is it that we think we've got to give that kind of thought to remodeling a kitchen? But I'll be honest, in the 20 years that I've been sharing, I haven't shared this exact thing, but in the 20 years I've been a parent, I have not yet had one father walk up to me after a seminar and go, by the way, here's my plan for my family. I've written it down just like you have, Mark. I'm the only guy I've ever met who's written it down. And most people think I'm not a planner. It's a funny world we live in, but that's okay if they think that. Well, what values do you want to pass on to your kid? I don't know, Bible ones. Yeah, what does that mean? What does that mean? What's the prime objective with your kids? I don't know. They want to be Christians? Well, how are you going to get them there? I don't know. What tools are you going to use? I don't know. That's not a good situation. Let me read you. I stole this morning. Where is it? It's right here. I stole it off the bulletin board down in the gym. I hope they don't mind. But it was a cheap piece of paper. I didn't think they'd mind. I couldn't agree with this more. It's a quote from Paul Bear Bryant, one of my mentors. It is not the will to win that matters. Everyone has the will to win. It is the will to prepare to win that really matters. And that's the problem. There is not, I want to identify the problem and then we'll talk about the solution. There's not a parent in here who has the will to win. Everybody in this room wants to win. The problem is, very few parents are preparing to win. Kathy, my wife, used to be a track star at Des Moines Hoover, and then she ran cross country at Iowa State. And God gave Kathy limited physical talents. She made the very most of them. Her coach told her, used to tell her, he said, Kathy, he said, kiddo, he said, if every kid on my team worked as hard as you did, most of the girls would be national championship finals. He said, bless your heart, God just didn't give you certain natural abilities to increase the speed level that you need to win like some of these Olympic athletes. But Kathy was still on the team. And she used to send an example to all the other girls of her work ethic. Of her work ethic. A lot of the girls looked up to her for that. But let me tell you something. You ever thought about this? A person who's running the 100-yard dash, now it's called the 100 meters. The race is, if you're really fast, in order to be world champion today, you've got to be at 10, at least under 10.5. Soon it'll be under 10. 10 seconds. Do any of you realize how many thousands of hours, days and years, go into preparing where nobody sees you for a 10-second race? 10-second race. You watch what you eat. You get enough sleep, especially if you want to compete at a world-class level. And you do stuff that hurts, and you do stuff you don't want to do, but you do it anyway. Why? Because real winners, are the people who do the preparatory work to win. Now, I know that you want to win with your family. I want to help entice you and motivate you to prepare to win. Okay? And that's what we're going to talk about right now. The first decision that you need to make, if you look at your sheet here, is where do you want your children to be in 20 years? Not now. Not when they're 5. Where do you want them to be in 20 years? You must start with the end product in mind. What kind of a product do you want your kids to be? I can honestly say to you, I knew in my mind, in my mind's eye, and I communicated with my wife, what the end product we wanted in our children. Now, the end product isn't completely done, but I knew when they were at 20 what I wanted them to be. I knew how I wanted them to think about the opposite sex. I knew what work ethic values I wanted them to have. I knew what kind of personality I wanted them to have. I have insisted that all of my children are outgoing and smile, whether it's their personality or not. And regularly, every one of my kids, 2 boys, 2 girls, all different temperaments, I couldn't control that. Have people tell them, you smile more than anyone else I've ever known in my life. My kids, the 2 oldest, used to get teased at school and have weird sexual things said to them because they were smiling so much. Every one of them. Because I knew what I wanted. Because I know that everything in life involves people. And we have to pass on to our children people skills, Kathy. I want them to be influencers. And you can't be a wallflower and be an influencer. You can't. I don't care if they're shy. Shy's no problem. I don't care. A lot of people think I'm sanguine. I want to tell you a little secret. Okay? This is really funny. Brent and I, you know, we know each other. We've been together for 12 and a half years, almost like we're married. And but we don't exactly fit together like a hand in glove, you know? And God has used us. He's used our differences. He's refined us on each other. But Brent, about, what was it, 3 months ago, 4 months, 5 months, he did this series where you took this personality test. Remember that one? Some of the other pastors did at your locations. So Mary goes, oh, Mark, you don't even take it. Mary and I figured you out years ago. You're a sanguine choleric. I said, Brent, I'm really not. He said, I know you are. I said, well, I'll tell you what, Brent, I'll take your test. If I take your test, will you abide by what the test says? Okay. He said, all right, I'm going to take your test. And I'm going to do my best to answer it like an unbeliever, Brent, okay? Because, you know, when you get the Holy Spirit, it really mixes you up, especially if you've been walking with the Lord for a long time. So I told Brent, I said, Brent, I won't tell you. I'll just take the test and then I'll tell you afterwards. So I took the test. I was 31 choleric, 6 melancholy, and 2 sanguine. And no phlegmatic. Not a phlegmatic bone in my body. I make peace because it's the right thing to do. Okay, I try. So I went to Brent. I've been telling Brent for a long time, Brent, I'm not a people person. You think I'm a people person? I'm not a people person. I don't like parties. I never went to one party in high school. I hate small talk. I hate it. I hate it. I'll go hide. I'll go walk off. You know, I got to go out in the woods somewhere. It's like, you know, you guys want to hang around small talk? I don't have time for small talk. You know, it's like, oh, gee, I just wears me out. Just wears me out. I love people. I've tried to grow in loving people because God loves them and died for them. That's really the honest to God truth. Melancholy has been very hard for me. I can get very easily depressed, very critical, very introspective, and extreme perfectionist. And I've really had to work on that in my life, I can be very opinionated and very overbearing. I've had to really work on that in my life. God's had to work me over. So, sometimes what people think you are, you aren't really. And so what I'm saying is, no matter what I was like or what my kids were like, I was trying to think what would be some good habits to develop in them. I'm not trying, and I'll get to this later, I've always tried to affirm their uniquenesses and their strengths. Okay? Now my son Jeremy, he's an ultra sanguine. I keep telling Jeremy, people go, you know, you're just like your dad. And I say, son, no, you're a new and improved model. You're going to be far greater than your father. I've told it to my daughters as well. They are the new and improved. I never had the start in life they had in life. I expect them to be far greater and accomplish far more things than I do. And I keep planting that dream in their mind because I really believe it'll be a reality. My son has a way with people. My daughter has a way with people in ways I just don't. And so I've always tried to affirm that, but there's certain things that I've known in my mind. I want them to look like this, act like this. I want these certain types of attitudes and behaviors to come out in their life. Okay? So what do I want them to look like? I don't mean physically, by the way. You know, where do I want to take these kids, and what do I want to accomplish? Those are the questions. You're going to have a little project later that you and husband and wife are going to do. You can use this sheet as a guideline. Go over it. But I want you to lock yourself out there on the grass somewhere or in your room. I assume, by the way, that many aren't going to do this, so that's okay. You're not going to disappoint me if you don't. But I would like to challenge you to sit in a room and ask each other these questions and write down on paper what you really think. What are the answers? What are the answers? Okay? Now, then you need to write it down and stick to your plan, okay? Now, I want to read this little note to you. I wrote here, when you're drawing out your plan, this is kind of like, you know, Mission Central, Mission Control, your NASA, your Mission Control, and you're figuring out how we're going to get this projectile to Mars. Now you need to take into factor in a whole lot of things like meteor storms that are going to come. It's going to tend to hit like your children's friends. Those will be meteor storms. And they're going to hit your child. And they're going to tend to want to drive them off course. You've got to have jet fuel packs that are on the other side hitting them with equal force to drive them back onto the path. And if you're negligent, your little projectile will end up in a whole galaxy that you never wanted them in. So you always have to be thinking. You always have to be ahead of the game. You always have to have this thing thought out so that you can react and respond proactively to the negative elements that come along in their lives. Another thing that's going to happen is you've got the gravitational of the pull of the sun that you're going to have to deal with. And your children are going to have the gravitational pull of the flesh and the world that you're going to have to deal with. And you have to prepare to meet that. And if you don't, and if you don't plan well, the gravitational pull will pull them in like it would pull you into the sun and burn them to a crisp. These are the kind of things that you need to think about. Okay? Now, the first thing you've got to decide then is what's your prime objective, all right, or your primary goal. So I put down here Mark's ultimate goal of parenting. If you have a different one, that's okay. Let's just read this one and see if maybe we could agree with it. Then you won't have to come up with your own. But if you want to write it in your own words, I'd really encourage you to go to the trouble of writing it. The ultimate goal of parenting, or the planet that I am aiming for. My ultimate goal, to develop children who will love, follow, and obey Christ with all their heart and throughout their whole life. And to give them the life skills and training needed to succeed as husband, wife, parent, person, and Christian. That's my goal. The first is to turn them into lovers and obeyers of God. Now, how do we do that? I'll comment on that as we go along. The second is to provide them with life skills, money management, emotion management, dealing with the opposite sex, character development, blah, 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 to succeed as a husband, because that's probably what my sons are going to end up being. As wife, that's probably what my daughters end up being. But if those don't happen, there'll be a person. So I put person in there, okay. They're probably going to be a parent. And they're definitely a Christian. And you need skills and abilities in all those areas. And I believe, personally, it's not the church's responsibility, but mine to give them to them. It's not the public school's job to give them to them. It's mine. If I choose in my realm of choice and in my plan to allow the public school system to have my children for a brief time in their life so that certain objectives, predetermined objectives that I have decided upon for their life skills are met, then that's fine. But don't just decide, well, this is how everybody else did it, I guess I'll just do it. Because if you're passive with them, they'll ruin their lives for you. And they'll be glad to do that for you too, by the way. They'll ruin their lives for you. Let me tell you a little travel tip, something that I saw happen to many parents as I was growing up. And as I got older, I understood the answer. Have you ever met these parents who are, you know, maybe they're older, they're 45, they're 50, and they're just godly as the day is long, at least they appear to be. And they're just sweet, and they love Jesus, and their Bible pages are worn thin, and they go to church, and they tithe, and they love their grandchildren, and their kids are a mess. Anybody ever know someone like that, you know? And you're scratching your head, and you're a young parent, and you think, oh my gosh, you're scared to death. What am I going to do? I mean, we tried everything we could do. We did everything we could do, blah, 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 blah. Right? You ever heard that? Man, I've heard it till I'm blue in the face, until you're sitting there crying with them. Do you know the one, I call this the Christian AIDS virus, that the devil plants in our young children, and many Christian parents passed, never realized it was going on. You know what it was? It was a parenting principle found in 1st or 2nd Corinthians, but no one ever called it a parenting principle. And it goes like this. Bad company corrupts good morals. Guess what I consider the public school system to be? The bad company that will corrupt my morals of my children. Now, if you decide, that doesn't mean you can't have your kids go to public school. What it does mean is you better get your eyes wide open. It does mean you better be a super, major, mega involved mother and father. Show up at the PTA, volunteer to help in school, and keep absolutely on top of everything that kid is learning and reading in that classroom and what kind of friends they're hanging around. Because they will gladly corrupt them. They'll ruin them. And as I've talked to these parents, I just began asking them, tell me about their friends. Oh, well, Mark, you know, they weren't always the friends we wanted. Then why'd you let them have them? Well, I don't know. We just didn't think there was anything we could do. And then I stopped there. Because all we're going to do now is cry, because when I tell them what they could have done, they're going to go, I wished I would have known it, but it's too late, so why go over it, right? Why go over it? But I'm telling it to you because you still have time. I've had parents sit down and talk with me. They go, Mark, my 13-year-old's running with the wrong crowd. I don't know what to do. I feel powerless. She sneaks off with them. They come over in their car. They sneak around. What do I do? And I said, do you really want me to answer that? I mean, I really do. I've said, I have to know. See, I have to know, especially when I'm one-on-one. You kind of knew what was coming when you came to this, so you walked in voluntarily. But people who sit down, I have to ask them now, do you really want to know? And I guess I need to know, are you willing to do whatever's necessary? I like what Sean Connery said to Kevin Costner in The Untouchables when he said, Ness, what are you prepared to do? Remember when he asked him, are you willing to get of Al Capone? You've got Al Capones in your child's life. Now, how far are you willing to go, Elliot? Because your family might get killed. They may come after you, Elliot. And Ness, of course, that was a big decision, a key point in the movie, when he said, I'm willing to go all the way. So I asked the parent that, and then they looked me in the eye and say, so what do? I say, move. That's what you do. You get them out of the school. And I don't care if they bawl, blubber, and scream. You move 30 miles away to another suburb with new friends. And you get them away from those friends. And if that's too much to ask of you, then I guess your house matters more to you than your kid. I'm not going to sit here and tell you you've all got to homeschool, or you got to go Christian school, or you got to go public school. But you are responsible to make the decision. So get up to the plate, be a man, and make the decision. Make the tough call. But don't sit around passively while some 13-year-old little piranhas ruin your kid's life. The teachers aren't bad. You understand what I'm saying? The teachers aren't bad. Many of the teachers, they love your kids. They do anything for your kids. The problem is they're surrounded every day by 30 or 40 little morons. Okay? And the Bible says the companion of fools suffers harm. I'm not making this up. I'm just trying to help you understand it in the reality in which we live. And if your little child is surrounded by a bunch of little fools, they're going to get hurt because their little tree isn't strong enough to withstand the wind. That's all. That's all. I remember one time I was in a grocery store and I'm walking through the checkout line, and this is one of the things I used to do with my kids, one of my tools. I go grocery shopping with my little girls, and Kathy was often sick, and so, and her back bothered her, so I have a lot of energy, as you can tell. But it's waning. It's waning. And so I would take them on Monday mornings real early, and we'd go, and we just had fun, and we always got a donut or a special thing together. I always say, hey, get a treat. You get a treat. I like getting treats with them. So we were up to the counter one day. Celeste was about 12 and Jesse was 11. And lady asked me a really weird question. Actually, the lady's now coming to church. Her name is Penny, and she teaches our Sunday school. And she comes to church all because she used to wait on us. We'd go through her cub line every time, and she would see my daughters, and she would talk to us. And she asked me something like, when your kids get older, are you going to let them have their license and all that? And I mean, you're going to trust them? And I looked at her back and I said, listen, ma'am, if I could not raise children that I trust, then I don't have any right having kids, do I? If you can't raise them, don't you have them? If I cannot raise children that I could trust, my gosh, what kind of a question is that? I trust my children explicitly. And at the same time, I talk with them. Like, for example, I'm going to give you a scenario. I talk to my son. He won't mind if I tell you this. Okay? I'm using my son because, I could use my daughter, and I'll use her in some other examples. But Jeremy, and Celeste, they've been getting to know all these new people. Really neat people. And they're having some of the neatest friends they've ever had in their life now who really want to follow God. There's this one young lady that Jeremy's met at the Rock. It's her and her sister, and he's gotten to know them. They've started coming, and they become really good friends with Celeste and Jeremy. This one sister, though, she's very affectionate. Very affectionate young lady. Very dear. Love these two girls. Just love the Lord and want to grow so bad. And they didn't really grow up in the best family, but they really want to grow and follow the Lord. And it's really cool to see. So, during Edgefest week, everybody got paired up. And Jeremy got paired up with this one young lady, which was fine with him and fine with her and fine with everybody else. So she was wondering, well, can we pray together each night on the phone, for Edgefest? Jeremy was, sure, all right, we can pray. So they'd call in about 10, and he'd pray, and, no problem. They'd talk. They became friends. They're pretty good friends. So One night they had been somewhere else, and she was bringing him home. And so I was sleeping on the couch this particular night, which I do fairly often just because I keep Kathy awake. I toss and turn all night. So it's another long story, but we do sleep together, just in case you wonder, but we don't often sleep in the same bed together, okay? So, anyway, I won't explain that. I'm just trying to see if you're awake here, following me, okay? So I noticed the headlights about 10:30. You know, I thought, okay, well, 10:30, there, he's home. So, you know, I waited 15 minutes. 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and by now I'm sitting up on the edge of the couch. I just don't believe this, you know? Get in the house, you know? What am I supposed to say, you know? So Jeremy comes in the house, and I can tell he's real happy, you know? And he's like, wow, you know? So I'm sitting on the edge of the couch. I said, Jeremy, oh, Dad, said, and he knows I'm sleeping out there. I said, how you doing, son? Great. I had a great night. I said, well, sit down for a second. I said, now, Jeremy, I said, I hate to tell you this, but, you know, I timed this. You've been sitting out in the driveway for 45 minutes. Wow, is it that long? I said, now, What were you doing? Well, you know, Dad, she wanted to pray, and she does. I mean, it's really cool. I feel kind of like I died and went to heaven. But he said, but you know, there's other things she wanted to talk about. And you know how it is, Dad. Girls, they start talking, and you just, how do you tell them to shut up? I gotta go. You know, I feel like I'd be being rude, you know. And I said, okay, now, Jeremy, I gotta ask this question. Did she reach over and hold your hand while you were praying? Well, yeah. I said, well, because she's real affectionate. She's just that kind of young lady. She didn't mean nothing by it. And I said, okay. I said, well, son, I said, here's the situation. Let me explain to you life, okay? We're just talking about life for just a moment. I said, I trust you completely. And you know what? I trust this young lady. I trust her. And I know that both your intentions are totally above board. But I said, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to predict the future for you. Once or twice a week, you come home, you pray out in the driveway, you know, you're sitting in the car, it's about 10 o'clock. You know, it goes on for a month, maybe 2 months, and then when you leave, she hugs you, you hug her, and next thing you know, you kiss her on the cheek. Because it just seems so natural to do. And next thing you know, you're passionately in love. And this isn't the time to get passionately in love, see? Because I got a plan for you. God's got a plan for you. Now, if this young lady or a young lady or like her turns out to be the person you end up with, that's fine by me, but we're talking 7 or 8 years, son. Do you understand that? 7 or 8 years. Okay? So, I said, now here's the reason why. You understand the reason why? Son, you're 18. From the day you came out of the womb, we have trained you for God. And I will not allow it to be screwed up by a woman. Okay? Not that this woman would, by the way. I think the world of this young lady and her sister and the other people that they've been getting to know, I just, like I said, kind of feel like I died and went to heaven. But I said, son, what we need to find out, and I've told this to my daughters, we need to find out if this young lady will continue to make the choices that you've already been making for years. I already know your choices. I don't know hers, and neither do you. So 7 years from now, or six, you know, I lowered a little bit. Six to eight, you know. If we find out she's the same passionate woman for God, wants to pray in her Bible, following the Lord, then we'll consider joining the rest of your life to this person. Because I'll tell you something, I've told my daughters this. I have this tactic. I scare them. And I'll get into this tomorrow. It's a very important tactic in my arsenal. Okay? And I sit down and I'll sit down with my daughters one day at the table, and I said, girls, I said, I want to share something with you. And I share with them a story, and it made me cry. It was a true story of someone we knew. I said, you know, they got married and they thought everything was great, and now they're getting divorced. They couldn't believe it was happening to this person. And I said, ladies, I said, I want to tell you something as a dad. Here's what's different between you and Jeremy. Jeremy will always be a son to me. He will always be a man. And it's his responsibility to the family. And you better believe if I don't think he's doing a good job with his wife, I'll grab him by the throat. Because I can. Because he's the head. You're my daughters. And once you get married, I'm not your head anymore. And if your husband says, we're moving to California because I like the weather there, I can't save you. And you can't leave. So we better make, and I said it just like this, we better make damn sure that the guy you marry is ready to run for the next 50 years of his life following God like your dad has. And that got their attention. I know how to get their attention. You have to learn how to get their attention. I love my kids. I'd do anything for them. What I'm saying, you see, with my son is that I knew I needed right there to begin implanting. See, the teaching process, it goes on. And then I told Jeremy, I said, now here's the plan, Jeremy. You can pray with her anytime you want. You can email back and forth. That's fine with me. You will not. You will not. You will not sit in a car on a dark night ever again. Do you understand that? Won't do it. You won't do it. Okay? Not because I do not trust you, because I think something weird is going to happen. It's not going to happen weird now. It's going to happen over time, and the temptation is going to get overwhelming. Later on, the next morning, he got up, and he came over. I was sitting at my computer real early in the morning answering some emails, and it was about 6, and he hasn't done this, and it was just kind of weird. He came up behind me and put his arms around my shoulders, my neck, and put his head next to mine. He's 18. He's a man. He said, Dad, I really appreciated you talking to me last night. And I want you to know I do trust you. If that's what you tell me I need to do, then I'll do it. And I just, you know, I just kind of cried. I have his heart. You have to get your kids' hearts. My daughter's the same way. I have her heart. She knows I love them. I'll do anything for them. And I'm not afraid to be the bad guy. But I'll always tell them why I'm doing this. Why? I said, son, you got to understand, you're far purer than I ever was at 18. But I'm still a guy. And this is a very wonderful girl. And in fact, I said, do you know what's harder? It's far harder sexual temptation when you meet a great Christian girl than a girl who's not following Christ, because there's far more reasons to love her. She's far more enticing than just a body. Because she's body, soul, and everything. And it's like, wow, this irresistible package. So you got to set your boundaries. Keep your head on straight. So that God can continue you in the race, lest you end up like Samson.